This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents The China Study, Revised and Expanded Edition, the most comprehensive study of nutrition ever conducted and the startling implications for diet, weight loss, and long-term health, by T. Colin Campbell, Ph.D., and Thomas M. Campbell II, M.D. This book is read by Dan Warren. To Karen Campbell, whose incredible love and caring made this book possible, and to Thomas McElwain Campbell and Betty DeMott Campbell for their incredible gifts. Preface from the first edition. T. Colin Campbell, at his core, is still a farm boy from Northern Virginia. When we spend time together, we inevitably share our stories from the farm. Whether it is spreading cow manure, driving tractors, or herding cattle, both of us share a rich history in farming. But from these backgrounds, both he and I went on to other careers. It is for his other career accomplishments that I came to admire Colin. He was involved in the discovery of a chemical later called dioxin, and he went on to direct one of the most important diet and health studies ever conducted, the China Study. In between, he authored hundreds of scientific papers, sat on numerous government expert panels, and helped shape national and international diet and health organizations, like the American Institute for Cancer Research, World Cancer Research Fund. As a scientist, he has played an instrumental role in how our country views diet and health. And yet, as I have gotten to know Colin on a personal level, I have come to respect him for reasons other than just his list of professional accomplishments. I have come to respect him for his courage and integrity. Colin seriously questions the status quo, and even though the scientific evidence is on his side, going against the grain is never easy. I know this well, because I have been a co-defendant with Oprah Winfrey when a group of cattlemen decided to sue her after she stated her intention not to eat beef. I have been in Washington, D.C., lobbying for better agricultural practices and fighting to change the way we raise and grow food in this country. I have taken on some of the most influential, well-funded groups in the country, and I know that it's not easy. Because of our parallel paths, I feel connected to Colin's story. We started on the farm, learning independence, honesty, and integrity in small communities, and went on to become established in mainstream careers. Although we both had success, I still remember the first seven-figure check I wrote for my massive cattle operation in Montana, we came to realize that the system we lived in could use some improvements. Challenging the system that provided us with such rewards has demanded an iron will and steadfast integrity. Colin has both, and this book is a brilliant capstone to a long and dignified career. We would do well to learn from Colin, who has reached the top of his profession and then had the courage to reach even higher by demanding change. Whether you have interest in your personal health or in the wretched state of health in the United States, this book will richly reward you. Read it carefully, absorb its information, and apply it to your life. Howard Lyman, author of Mad Cowboy. Foreword. From the first edition. If you are like most Americans today, you are surrounded by fast food chain restaurants. You are barraged by ads for junk foods. You see other ads for weight loss programs that say you can eat whatever you want, not exercise, and still lose weight. It's easier to find a Snickers bar, a Big Mac, or a Coke than it is to find an apple. And your kids eat at a school cafeteria, whose idea of a vegetable is the ketchup on the burgers. You go to your doctor for health tips. In the waiting room, you find a glossy 243-page magazine titled Family Doctor, Your Essential Guide to Health and Well-Being, published by the American Academy of Family Physicians and sent free to the offices of all 50,000 family doctors in the United States. It's filled with full-page color ads for McDonald's, Dr. Pepper, chocolate pudding, and Oreo cookies. You pick up an issue of National Geographic Kids, a magazine published by the National Geographic Society for ages 6 and up, expecting to find wholesome reading for youngsters. The pages, however, are filled with ads for Twinkies, M&Ms, Frosted Flakes, Fruit Loops, Hostess Cupcakes, and Extreme Jell-O Pudding Sticks. This is what scientists and food activists at Yale University call a toxic food environment. It is the environment in which most of us live today. The inescapable fact is that certain people are making an awful lot of money today selling foods that are unhealthy. They want you to keep eating the foods they sell, even though doing so makes you fat, depletes your vitality, and shortens and degrades your life. They want you docile, compliant, and ignorant. They do not want you informed, active, and passionately alive, and they are quite willing to spend billions of dollars annually to accomplish their goals. You can acquiesce to all this. You can succumb to the junk food sellers, or you can find a healthier and more life-affirming relationship with your body and the food you eat. If you want to live with radiant health, lean and clear and alive in your body, you'll need an ally in today's environment. Fortunately, you have in your hand just such an ally. T. Colin Campbell, Ph.D., is widely recognized as a brilliant scholar, a dedicated researcher, and a great humanitarian. Having had the pleasure and privilege to be his friend, I can attest to all of that, and I can also add something else. He is also a man of humility and human depth, a man whose love for others guides his every step. Dr. Campbell's new book, The China Study, is a great ray of light in the darkness of our times, illuminating the landscape and the realities of diet and health so clearly, so fully, that you need never again fall prey to those who profit from keeping you misinformed, confused, and obediently eating the foods they sell. One of the many things I appreciate about this book is that Dr. Campbell doesn't just give you his conclusions. He doesn't preach from on high, telling what you should and shouldn't eat, as if you were a child. Instead, like a good and trusted friend who happens to have learned, discovered, and done more in his life than most of us could ever imagine, he gently, clearly, and skillfully gives you the information and data you need to fully understand what's involved in diet and health today. He empowers you to make informed choices. Sure, he makes recommendations and suggestions, and terrific ones at that. But he always shows you how he has arrived at his conclusions. The data and the truth are what are important. His only agenda is to help you live as informed and healthy a life as possible. I've read the China Study twice already, and each time I've learned an immense amount. This is a brave and wise book. The China Study is extraordinarily helpful, superbly written, and profoundly important. Dr. Campbell's work is revolutionary in its implications and spectacular in its clarity. If you want to eat bacon and eggs for breakfast and then take cholesterol-lowering medication, that's your right. But if you want to truly take charge of your health, read the China Study, and do it soon. If you heed the counsel of this outstanding guide, your body will thank you every day for the rest of your life. John Robbins, author of Diet for a New America, Reclaiming Our Health and the Food Revolution. Introduction. The public's hunger for nutrition information never ceases to amaze me. Even after devoting my entire working life to conducting experimental research into nutrition and health. Diet books are perennial bestsellers. Almost every popular magazine features nutrition advice. Newspapers regularly run articles. And TV and radio programs constantly discuss diet and health. On the internet, you can shop for health advice of any persuasion that suits your fancy. Given the barrage of information, are you confident that you know what you should be doing to improve your health? Should you buy food that is labeled organic to avoid pesticide exposure? Are environmental chemicals a primary cause of cancer? Or is your health predetermined by the genes you inherited when you were born? Do carbohydrates really make you fat? Should you be more concerned about the total amount of fat you eat, or just saturated fats and trans fats? What vitamins, if any, should you be taking? Do you buy foods that are fortified with extra fiber? Should you eat fish, and if so, how often? Will eating soy foods prevent heart disease? My guess is that you're really not sure of the answers to these questions. If this is the case, then you aren't alone. Even though information and opinions are plentiful, very few people truly know what they should be doing to improve their health. This isn't because the research hasn't been done. It has. We know an enormous amount about the links between nutrition and health. But the real science has been buried beneath a clutter of irrelevant or even harmful information, junk science, fad diets, and food industry propaganda. I want to change that. I want to give you a new framework for understanding nutrition and health, a framework that eliminates confusion, prevents and treats disease, and allows you to live a more fulfilling life. I have been in the system for almost 60 years, often at the very highest levels, designing and directing large research projects, deciding which research gets funded, and translating massive amounts of scientific research into national expert panel reports. After a long career in research, policymaking, and lecturing to a wide variety of public and professional audiences, I now understand why Americans are so confused. As a taxpayer who foots the bill for research and health policy in America, you deserve to know that many of the common notions you have been told about food, health, and disease are wrong. Synthetic chemicals in the environment and in your food, as problematic as they may be, are not the main cause of cancer. The genes that you inherit from your parents are not the most important factors in determining whether you fall prey to any of the 10 leading causes of death. The hope that genetic research will eventually lead to drug cures for diseases ignores more powerful solutions that can be employed today. Obsessively controlling your intake of any one nutrient, such as carbohydrates, fat, cholesterol, or omega-3 fats, will not result in long-term health. Vitamins and nutrient supplements do not give you long-term protection against disease. Drugs and surgery don't cure the diseases that kill most Americans. Your doctor probably does not know what you need to do to be the healthiest you can be. I propose to do nothing less than redefine what we think of as good nutrition. The provocative results of my 4 decades of experimental research, including the findings from a 27-year laboratory program funded by the most reputable funding agencies, prove that eating right can save your life. I will not ask you to believe conclusions based on my personal observations, as some popular authors do. There are over 800 references in this book, and the vast majority of them are primary sources of information, including hundreds of scientific publications from other researchers that point the way to less cancer, less heart disease, fewer strokes, less obesity, less diabetes, less autoimmune disease, less osteoporosis, less Alzheimer's, fewer kidney stones, and less blindness. Some of the findings, published in the most reputable scientific journals, show that dietary change can enable diabetic patients to go off their medication. Heart disease can be reversed with diet alone, and in doing so, reducing animal protein is more significant than reducing saturated fat. Breast cancer is related to levels of female hormones in the blood, which are determined by the food we eat. Consuming dairy foods can increase the risk of prostate cancer. Antioxidants found in fruits and vegetables are linked to better mental performance in old age. Kidney stones can be prevented by a healthy diet. Type 1 diabetes, one of the most devastating diseases that can befall a child, is convincingly linked to infant feeding practices. These findings demonstrate that a good diet is the most powerful weapon we have against disease and sickness. An understanding of this scientific evidence is not only important for improving health, it also has profound implications for our society, as well as societies around the world. We must know why misinformation dominates our cultural conversation, and why we are grossly mistaken in how we investigate diet and disease, how we promote health, and how we treat illness. By any number of measures, America's health is failing. We spend far more per capita on health care than any other society in the world, yet 2/3 of Americans are overweight, and over 25 million Americans have diabetes, an increase of about 10 million since the first edition of this book. Heart disease is still the number one cause of death, just as it was 40 years ago, and the war on cancer, launched in the 1970s, has been a miserable failure. Half of Americans have a health problem that requires taking a prescription drug every week. Though the number of Americans with high cholesterol has been on a mysterious downward trend over the last few decades, there are still over 70 million who are living with this condition. To make matters worse, we are leading our youth down a path of disease earlier and earlier in their lives. 1/3 of the young people in this country are overweight or at risk of becoming overweight. Increasingly, they are falling prey to a form of diabetes that used to be seen only in adults, and these young people now take more prescription drugs than ever before. These issues all come down to three things: breakfast, lunch, and dinner. 60 years ago, at the beginning of my career, I would have never guessed that food is so closely related to health problems. For years, I never gave much thought to which foods were best to eat. I just ate what everyone else did, what I was told was good food. We all eat what is tasty, or what is convenient, or what our parents taught us to prefer. Most of us live within cultural boundaries that define our food preferences and habits. So it was with me. I was raised on a dairy farm, where milk was central to our existence. We were told in school that cow's milk made strong, healthy bones and teeth. It was nature's most perfect food. On our farm, we produced most of our own food in the garden or in the livestock pastures. I was the first in my family to go to college. I studied pre-veterinary medicine at Penn State, and then attended veterinary school at the University of Georgia for a year, when Cornell University beckoned with scholarship money for me to do graduate research in animal nutrition. I transferred in part because they were going to pay me to go to school instead of me paying them. There, I did a master's degree. I was the last graduate student of Professor Clive McKay, a Cornell professor famed for extending the lives of rats by feeding them much less food than they would otherwise eat. My PhD research at Cornell was devoted to finding better ways to make cows and sheep grow faster. I was attempting to improve on our ability to produce animal protein, the cornerstone of what I was told was good nutrition. I was on a trail to promote better health by advocating the consumption of more meat, milk, and eggs. It was an obvious sequel to my own life on the farm, and I was happy to believe that the American diet was the best in the world. Through these formative years, I encountered a recurring theme. We were supposedly eating the right foods, especially plenty of high-quality animal protein. Much of my early career was spent working with two of the most toxic chemicals ever discovered, dioxin and aflatoxin. I initially worked at MIT, where I was assigned a chicken feed puzzle. Millions of chicks a year were dying from an unknown toxic chemical in their feed, and I had the responsibility of isolating and determining the structure of this chemical. After 2.5 years, I helped discover dioxin, arguably the most toxic chemical ever found. This chemical has since received widespread attention, especially because it was part of the herbicide 2,4-5-T, or Agent Orange, then being used to defoliate forests in the Vietnam War. After leaving MIT and taking a faculty position at Virginia Tech, I began coordinating technical assistance for a nationwide project in the Philippines working with malnourished children. Part of the project became an investigation of the unusually high prevalence of liver cancer, usually an adult disease, in Filipino children. It was thought that high consumption of aflatoxin, a mold toxin found in peanuts and corn, caused this problem. Aflatoxin has been called one of the most potent carcinogens ever discovered. For 10 years, our primary goal in the Philippines was to improve childhood malnutrition among the poor, a project funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development. Eventually, we established about 110 nutrition self-help education centers around the country. The aim of these efforts in the Philippines was simple: make sure that children were getting as much protein as possible. It was widely thought that much of the childhood malnutrition in the world was caused by a lack of protein, especially from animal-based foods. Universities and governments around the world were working to alleviate a perceived protein gap in the developing world. In this project, however, I uncovered a dark secret. Children who ate the highest protein diets were the ones most likely to get liver cancer. They were the children of the wealthiest families. I then noticed a research report from India that had some very provocative, relevant findings. Indian researchers had studied two groups of rats. In one group, they administered the cancer-causing aflatoxin, then fed a diet that was composed of 20% protein, a level near what many of us consume in the West. In the other group, they administered the same amount of aflatoxin, but then fed a diet that was only composed of 5% protein. Incredibly, every single animal that consumed the 20% protein diet had evidence of liver cancer, and every single animal that consumed a 5% protein diet avoided liver cancer. It was a 100-0 score, leaving no doubt that nutrition trumped chemical carcinogens, even very potent carcinogens, in controlling cancer. This information countered everything I had been taught. It was heretical to say that protein wasn't healthy, let alone say it promoted cancer. It was a defining moment in my career. Investigating such a provocative question so early in my career was not a very wise choice. Questioning protein and animal-based foods in general ran the risk of my being labeled a heretic, even if it passed the test of good science. But I never was much for following directions, just for the sake of following directions. When I first learned to drive a team of horses or herd cattle, to hunt animals, to fish our creek, or to work in the fields, I came to accept that independent thinking was part of the deal. It had to be. Encountering problems in the field meant that I had to figure out what to do next. It was a great classroom, as any farm boy can tell you. That sense of independence has stayed with me until today. So, faced with a difficult decision, I decided to start an in-depth laboratory program that would investigate the role of nutrition, especially protein, in the development of cancer. My colleagues and I were cautious in framing our hypotheses, rigorous in our methodology, and conservative in interpreting our findings. I chose to do this research at a very basic science level, studying the biochemical details of cancer formation. It was important to understand not only whether, but also how, protein might promote cancer. It was the best of all worlds. By carefully following the rules of good science, I was able to study a provocative topic without provoking knee-jerk responses that arise with radical ideas. Eventually, this research became handsomely funded for 27 years by the best-reviewed and most competitive funding sources, mostly the National Institutes of Health, NIH, the American Cancer Society, and the American Institute for Cancer Research. Then our results were reviewed a second time for publication in many of the best scientific journals. What we found was shocking. Low protein diets inhibited the initiation of cancer by aflatoxin, regardless of how much this carcinogen was administered to these animals. After cancer initiation was completed, low-protein diets also dramatically blocked subsequent cancer growth. In other words, the cancer-producing effects of this highly carcinogenic chemical were rendered insignificant by a low-protein diet. In fact, dietary protein proved to be so powerful in its effect that we could turn on and turn off cancer growth simply by changing the level consumed. Furthermore, the amounts of protein being fed were those that we humans routinely consume. We didn't use extraordinary levels, as is so often the case in carcinogen studies. But that's not all. We found that not all proteins had this effect. What protein consistently and strongly promoted cancer? Casein, which makes up 87% of cow's milk protein, promoted all stages of the cancer process. What type of protein did not promote cancer, even at high levels of intake? The safe proteins were from plants, including wheat and soy. As this picture came into view, it began to challenge and then to shatter some of my most cherished assumptions. These experimental animal studies didn't end there. I went on to direct what was, at the time, the most comprehensive study of diet, lifestyle, and disease ever done with humans in the history of biomedical research. It was a massive undertaking, jointly arranged through Cornell University, Oxford University, and the Chinese Academy of Preventive Medicine. The New York Times called it the Grand Prix of Epidemiology. This project surveyed a vast range of diseases and diet and lifestyle factors in rural China and, 6 years later, in Taiwan. More commonly known as the China Study, this project eventually produced more than 8,000 statistically significant associations between various dietary factors and disease. What made this project especially remarkable is that, among the many associations that are relevant to diet and disease, so many pointed to the same finding. People who ate the most animal-based foods got the most chronic disease. Even relatively small intakes of animal-based food were associated with adverse effects. People who ate the most plant-based foods were the healthiest and tended to avoid chronic disease. These results could not be ignored. From the initial experimental animal studies on animal protein effects to this massive human study on dietary patterns, the findings proved to be consistent. The health implications of consuming either animal or plant-based nutrients were remarkably different. I could not and did not rest on the findings of our animal studies and the massive human study in China, however impressive they may have been. I sought out the findings of other researchers and clinicians. The findings of these individuals have proved to be some of the most exciting findings of the past 50 years. These findings, the contents of Part 2 of this book, show that heart disease, diabetes, and obesity can be reversed by a healthy diet. Other research shows that various cancers, autoimmune diseases, bone health, kidney health, vision and brain disorders in old age, like cognitive dysfunction and Alzheimer's, are convincingly influenced by diet. Most importantly, the diet that has time and again been shown to reverse and/or prevent these diseases is the same whole foods, plant-based, WFPB, diet that I had found to promote optimal health in my laboratory research and in the China study. The findings are consistent. Yet, despite the power of this information, despite the hope it generates, and despite the urgent need for this understanding of nutrition and health, people are still confused. I have friends with heart disease who are resigned and despondent about being at the mercy of what they consider to be an inevitable disease. I've talked with women who are so terrified of breast cancer that they wish to have their own breasts, even their daughter's breasts, surgically removed, as if that's the only way to minimize risk. So many of the people I have met have been led down a path of illness, despondency, and confusion about their health and what they can do to protect it. Americans are confused, and I will tell you why. The answer, discussed in Part 4, has to do with how health information is generated and communicated and who controls such activities. Because I have been behind the scenes generating health information for so long, I have seen what really goes on, and I'm ready to tell the world what is wrong with the system. The distinctions between government, industry, science, and medicine have become blurred. The distinctions between making a profit and promoting health have become blurred. The problems with the system do not come in the form of Hollywood-style corruption. The problems are much more subtle, and yet much more dangerous. The result is massive amounts of misinformation, for which average American consumers pay twice. They provide the tax money to do the research, and then they provide the money for their health care to treat their largely preventable diseases. This story, starting from my personal background and culminating in a new understanding of nutrition and health, is the subject of this book. After spending time at MIT and Virginia Tech, then coming back to Cornell over 40 years ago, I was charged with the task of integrating the concepts and principles of chemistry, biochemistry, physiology, and toxicology in an upper-level course in nutritional biochemistry. 20 years ago at Cornell University, I organized and taught a new elective course called Vegetarian Nutrition. It was the first such course on an American university campus and proved far more successful than I could have imagined. The course focused on the health value of a plant-based diet. This course is now organized online by a nonprofit organization that I founded and that has partnered with the Cornell University program that does online courses for faculty. Headed by a longtime associate of mine, Jenny Miller, under the medical direction of my son and co-author, Thomas Campbell, M.D., it has emerged among the most popular of the 200-plus courses offered by the Cornell online group. After more than 4 decades of scientific research, education, and policy making at our society's highest levels, I had gained considerable confidence that I could adequately integrate my research findings and experiences into a cogent story. Many readers of the first edition of this book, and viewers of 3 especially successful documentary movies in which our work was featured, Forks Over Knives and Plant Pure Nation in the United States, directed by my son Nelson, and Plan Eat in England, spelled PLANEAT, have told me that their lives have been changed for the better. In many cases, the information was life-saving. That's what I and Tom intend to keep doing in this second edition. I hope your life is changed as well. Part 1. The China Study. Chapter 1. Problems We Face, Solutions We Need. He who does not know food, how can he understand the diseases of man? Hippocrates, the father of medicine, 460 to 357 BC. On a golden morning in 1946, when summer was all tuckered out and fall wanted to be let in, all you could hear on my family's dairy farm was quiet. There was no growl from cars driving by or airplanes burning trails overhead. Just quiet. There were the songbirds, of course, and the cows, and the roosters who would chime in once in a while, but these noises merely filled out the quiet, the peace. Standing on the second floor of our barn, with the immense brown doors gaping open, allowing the sun to soak through, I was a happy 12-year-old. I had just finished a big country breakfast of eggs, bacon, sausage, fried potatoes, and ham with a couple of glasses of whole milk. My mom had cooked a fantastic meal. I had been working up my appetite since 4:30 a.m. when I had gotten up to milk the cows with my father Tom and my brother Jack. My father, then 45, stood with me in the quiet sun. He opened a 50-pound sack of alfalfa seed, dumped all the tiny seeds on the wooden barn floor in front of us, and then opened a box containing fine black powder. The powder, he explained, was bacteria that would help the alfalfa grow. They would attach themselves to the seeds and become part of the roots of the growing plant throughout its life. Having had only 2 years of formal education, my father was proud of knowing that the bacteria helped the alfalfa convert nitrogen from the air into protein. The protein, he explained, was good for the cows that would eventually eat it. So our work that morning was to mix the bacteria and the alfalfa seeds before planting. Always curious, I asked my dad why it worked and how. He was glad to explain it, and I was glad to hear it. This was important knowledge for a farm boy. 17 years later, in 1963, my father had his first heart attack. He was 61. At age 70, he died from a second massive coronary. I was devastated. My father, who had stood with my siblings and me for so many days in the quiet countryside, teaching us the things that I still hold dear in life, was gone. Now, after decades of doing experimental research on diet and health, I know that the very disease that killed my father, heart disease, can be prevented, even reversed. Vascular, arteries, and heart health is possible without life-threatening surgery and without potentially lethal drugs. I have learned that it can be achieved simply by eating the right food. This is the story of how food can change our lives. I have spent my career in research and teaching, unraveling the complex mystery of why health eludes some and embraces others, and I now know that food primarily determines the outcome. This information could not come at a better time. Our healthcare system costs too much, excludes far too many people, and neither promotes health nor prevents disease. Volumes have been written on how the problem might be solved, but progress has been painfully slow. Sickness, anyone? If you are male in this country, the American Cancer Society says that you have a 47% lifetime chance of getting cancer. If you are female, you fare a little better, but you still have a whopping 38% lifetime chance of getting cancer. The rates at which we die from cancer are among the highest in the world, and except for continuing declines in some cancers due to preventing exposure to well-known cancer initiators, avoiding tobacco for lung cancer, and brine-preserved food for stomach cancer, it has been getting worse, as seen in Chart 1.1. Despite 47 years of the massively funded war on cancer, we have made only a small amount of progress beyond controlling these exposures or finding better cancer treatments. Contrary to what many believe, cancer is not a natural event. Adopting a healthy diet and lifestyle can prevent a sizable number of cancers in the United States. Old age can and should be graceful and peaceful. But cancer is only part of a larger picture of disease and death in America. Looking elsewhere, we see that there is an overall pattern of poor health. For example, we are rapidly becoming the heaviest people on Earth. Overweight Americans now significantly outnumber those who maintain a healthy weight. As shown in Chart 1.2, our rates of obesity have been skyrocketing over the past several decades. According to the National Center for Health Statistics, as of 2015, more than a third of the adults 20 years of age and over in this country are obese. One is considered obese if he or she is carrying more than a third of a person above and beyond a healthy weight. Similarly frightening trends have been occurring in children as young as 2 years of age. But cancer and obesity are not the only epidemics casting a large shadow over American health. Diabetes has also increased in unprecedented proportions. 1 out of 11 Americans now has diabetes, and that ratio continues to rise. If we don't heed the importance of diet, millions of additional Americans will unknowingly develop diabetes and suffer its consequences, including blindness, limb amputation, cardiovascular disease, kidney disease, and premature death. Despite this, fast food restaurants that serve nutritionally defunct foods are now fixtures in almost every town. We eat out more than ever, and speed has taken precedence over quality. As we spend more time watching TV, playing video games, and using the computer, we are less physically active. Both diabetes and obesity are merely symptoms of poor health in general. They rarely exist in isolation of other diseases, and often forecast deeper, more serious health problems, such as heart disease, cancer, and stroke. In our first edition, we reported two frightening statistics: that diabetes among people in their 30s had increased 70% in less than 10 years, and that the percentage of obese people had nearly doubled in the past 30 years. Such an incredibly fast increase in these signal diseases in America's young to middle-aged population forecasted a healthcare catastrophe on the horizon that may become an unbearable burden on a health system that is already strained in countless ways. Diabetes statistics. Percent increase in incidence from 1990 to 1998. Age 30 to 39, 70%. Age 40 to 49, 40%. Age 50 to 59, 31%. Percent of diabetics who aren't aware of their illness, 34%. Diabetes outcomes: heart disease and stroke, blindness, kidney disease, nervous system disorders, dental disease, limb amputation. Annual economic cost of diabetes: $98 billion. Since that ominous forecast, the latest 2012 American Diabetes Association figures now show that the total cost for diabetes is even higher, at $245 billion, with more than 20% of total health care costs being directly attributable to diabetes. In just two recent years, between 2010 and 2012, the number of people with diabetes increased 13%, from 25.8 million to 29.1 million. We're well on the way to that catastrophe. But the most pervasive killer in our culture is not obesity, diabetes, or cancer. It still is heart disease. Heart disease will kill one out of every three Americans. According to the American Heart Association, over 60 million Americans currently suffer from some form of cardiovascular disease, including high blood pressure, stroke, and heart disease. Like me, you undoubtedly have known someone who died of heart disease. But since my own father died from a heart attack almost 50 years ago, a great amount of knowledge has been uncovered in understanding this disease. The most dramatic recent finding is that very close to 100% of heart disease can be prevented and even reversed by a healthy diet. People who cannot perform the most basic physical activity because of severe angina can find a new life simply by changing their diets. By embracing this revolutionary information, we could collectively defeat the most dangerous disease in this country. Oops, we didn't mean to have that happen. As increasing numbers of Americans fall victim to chronic diseases, we hope that our hospitals and doctors will do all that they can to help us. Unfortunately, in recent decades, both the newspapers and the courts have been filled with stories and cases that tell us that inadequate care has become the norm. Although, since the first edition of this book, I have seen increasing interest within the medical community in the role that diet and nutrition might play in healthcare. One of the most well-regarded voices representing the medical community, the Journal of the American Medical Association, had, as of the writing of the first edition, published an article by Barbara Starfield, M.D., stating that physician error, medication error, and adverse events from drugs or surgery were killing 225,400 people per year. See Chart 1.5. thus making our healthcare system the third leading cause of death in the United States, behind only cancer and heart disease. See Chart 1.4. The last and largest category of deaths in this group were the hospitalized patients who were dying from the noxious, unintended, and undesired effect of a drug when administered at normal doses. Even with the use of approved medicines and correct medication procedures, over 100,000 people were dying every year from unintended reactions to the medicine that was intended to revive their health. Incidentally, this same report, which summarized and analyzed 39 separate studies, found that almost 7%, 1 out of 15, of all hospitalized patients had experienced a serious adverse drug reaction, one that requires hospitalization, prolongs hospitalization, is permanently disabling, or results in death. These are people who took their medicine as directed. This number does not include the tens of thousands of people who suffered from the incorrect administration and use of these drugs. Nor does it include adverse drug events that are labeled possible effects, or drugs that do not accomplish their intended goal. In other words, 1 out of 15 was a conservative number. Has anything changed in the past 10 years? No. By all indications, it has, if anything, become worse. In 2013, a new assessment found that a lower limit of 210,000 deaths per year was associated with preventable harm in hospitals, but the true number of premature deaths associated with preventable harm to patients was estimated at more than 400,000 per year. It also found that serious harm seems to be 10 to 20-fold more common than lethal harm. This assessment was based on 4 key studies published between 2008 and 2011, and the methodology appears to be more thorough and reliable than that of the previous report. No one can doubt this trend in increasingly poor performance in healthcare in hospitals. Indeed, the most recent report calls for an outcry of overdue changes and increased vigilance in medical care, especially by systematic listening to the harmed patients and their survivors. One thing is certain: official health agencies continue to turn a deaf ear. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which publishes the government's list of top 10 causes of death, still fails to list deaths from medical care at all, much less where it belongs as the third leading cause of death in this country. If nutrition were better understood, and prevention and natural treatments were more accepted in the medical community, we would not be pouring so many toxic, potentially lethal drugs into our bodies at the last stage of disease. We would not be frantically searching for the new medicine that alleviates the symptoms, but often does nothing to address the fundamental causes of our illnesses. We would not be spending our money developing, patenting, and commercializing magic bullet drugs that often cause additional health problems. The current system has not lived up to its Hippocratic oath to do no harm. It is time to shift our thinking toward a broader perspective on health, one that includes a proper understanding and use of good nutrition. As I look back on what I've learned, I am appalled that the circumstances surrounding the way in which Americans die are often unnecessarily early, painful, and costly. An expensive grave. We pay more for our health care than any other country in the world. See Chart 1.6. In 1997, we spent over $1 trillion on health care. As we wrote in 2005, the cost of our health was spiraling so far out of control that the Healthcare Financing Administration had predicted that our system would cost $16 trillion by 2030. Costs so consistently outpaced inflation that we were spending $1 out of every $7 the economy produced on health care. See Chart 1.7. We had seen almost a 300% increase in expenditures as a percentage of GDP in less than 40 years. What was all the extra financing buying? Was it creating health? I say no, and many serious commentators agree. In 2013, the health status of 34 countries, including the U.S., Canada, Australia, and several Western European countries, was compared using a variety of different indicators of healthcare efficacy. Other countries spent one-half or less of what the U.S. spent per capita on healthcare, making it seem reasonable, therefore, for us to expect our system to rank above theirs. Unfortunately, among these countries, the U.S. system was consistently among the worst performers. In a separate analysis, as reported in the first edition of this book, the World Health Organization ranked the United States 37th best in the world, according to healthcare system performance. As of this writing, our life expectancy is less than average, 4.2 fewer years for men and 4.8 fewer years less for women compared to Switzerland. Our healthcare system is clearly not the best in the world, even though we spend far more money per capita on it. Also, during this last decade, we suffered a substantial economic recession, in the midst of which we debated how to reconstruct our healthcare system. In October 2013, the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, went into effect, and it is not yet clear what effect it may have on trends in healthcare spending. Therefore, it is difficult to predict what costs might be in the next few years. However, in 2013, the U.S. still spent more money per capita by a wide margin than any of the 34 OECD countries. It also should be noted that, except for Greece and Poland, both of which have suffered economic difficulties, all the OECD countries have universal health coverage, except for the U.S. The projected total health care spending in the U.S. for 2015 is now at $2.8 trillion, more than doubling the 1997 estimate cited previously. Additionally, and even more alarmingly, we are spending a higher and higher proportion of our disposable income on health care. According to Deruji, the share of American GDP devoted to health spending grew from 9% in the 1980s to about 18% of GDP in 2011. The government centers for Medicare and Medicaid services now estimate that healthcare spending will be 19.9% of GDP by 2022. Using this much of our income for our healthcare was unsustainable when we wrote the first edition. Now it is even more so. How far can this go? There also has been curiosity in recent years as to what effect the recession has had on escalating healthcare costs. PricewaterhouseCoopers, a professional services company, claims that the five-year, 2007 to 2011, slowdown in the customary inflation of healthcare costs has ended and the upward trend has resumed. Healthcare cost inflation rates were 6.5% in 2014. And 6.8% in 2015. By comparison, overall inflation was only 1.58% in 2014 and minus 0.09% in 2015. In other words, healthcare costs during the period from 2007 to 2015 have been eating up a larger and larger share of our income and continued to grow even when the overall economy was contracting. This is unsustainable. What I find peculiar about these various trends and projections is the unusual attention given to the more detailed properties of the healthcare cost program. Issues like trends in development and costs of specialty drugs, location of physician practices inside and outside hospital settings, streamlining of administrative matters, and consumer shopping for more cost-effective healthcare plans, while discussion of the larger perspective has been minimized. Namely, we are arguing over the minutiae of who is going to pay for healthcare services, rather than implementing the public health, nutrition, and lifestyle measures we already know will significantly reduce our need for services to begin with. To use a metaphor, a fire is starting in the foundation of our house, and instead of putting the fire out, we are fixated on buying low-cost fire retardant for the upstairs bedrooms. Too often in the United States, a doctor's treatment decisions are made based on what will be reimbursed by health insurance, rather than what is best for the patient's health. The consequences of not having health insurance, I suspect, have never been more terrifying. As of the writing of the first edition, close to 44 million Americans were uninsured. This number continued to rise since until 2013, when it was 14.4% of the total population, 45.4 million, before dropping to 11.5% in 2014, 36.8 million, and 9.2% in 2015, 29.4 million, in response to the adoption of the Affordable Care Act. It's unacceptable to me that we have been spending more money on health care than any other country on this planet, and we still have tens of millions of people without access to basic care. From three perspectives, disease prevalence, medical care efficacy, and economics, we have a deeply troubled medical system. But I do not do justice to this topic simply by recounting figures and statistics. Many of us have spent awful times in hospitals or in nursing homes watching a loved one succumb to disease. Perhaps you've been a patient yourself, and you know firsthand how poorly the system sometimes functions. Isn't it paradoxical that the system that is supposed to heal us too often hurts us? Working to lessen confusion. The American people need to know the truth. They need to know what we have uncovered in our research. People need to know why we are unnecessarily sick, why too many of us die early, despite the billions spent on research. The irony is that the solution is simple and inexpensive. The answer to the American health crisis is the food that each of us chooses to put in our mouths each day. It's as simple as that. Although many of us think we're well-informed on nutrition, we're not. We tend to follow one faddish diet after another. We disdain saturated fats, butter, or carbohydrates, and then embrace vitamin E, calcium supplements, aspirin or zinc, and focus our energy and effort on extremely specific food components, as if this will unlock the secrets of health. All too often, fancy outweighs fact. Perhaps you remember the protein diet fad that gripped the country in the late 1970s. The promise was that you could lose weight by replacing real food with a protein shake. In a very short while, almost 60 women died from the diet. In recent decades, millions have adopted high-protein, high-fat diets based on books such as Dr. Atkins' New Diet Revolution, Protein Power, The South Beach Diet, Good Calories, Bad Calories, and The Paleo Diet. There is increasing evidence that these modern protein fads continue to inflict a great variety of dangerous health disorders. What we don't know, what we don't understand about nutrition can hurt us. I've been wrestling with this public confusion for more than two decades. In 1988, I was invited before the U.S. Senate Governmental Affairs Committee, chaired by Senator John Glenn, to give my views on why the public is so confused about diet and nutrition. After examining this issue both before and since that testimony, I can confidently state that one of the major sources of confusion is this. Far too often, we scientists focus on details while ignoring the larger context. For example, we pin our efforts and our hopes on one isolated nutrient at a time, whether it is vitamin A to prevent cancer or vitamin E to prevent heart attacks. We oversimplify and disregard the infinite complexity of nature. Often, investigating minute biochemical parts of food and trying to reach broad conclusions about diet and health leads to contradictory results. Contradictory results lead to confused scientists and policymakers. and to an increasingly confused public. A different kind of prescription.